Okay.
Okay, recording.
Hi everybody. Okay, so I'm going to title this talk in along the lines of the theme of being in the body in the house. I want to call this 10% lighter. Grandparenting myself with the subtitles: The body is my God Spark's house. Practicing for freedom, and Bubby consciousness and the inner infant. So those are my those are my themes that I'm going to be working with, and hopefully it comes together and is helpful for you in your practice as you continue practicing today and throughout the retreat. So I guess the where I need to kind of start is the why of my practice. So why do I practice? I practice because I want to be kinder. I want to be more awake in my life and conscious. And I see all of that as part of kind of a homecoming, a coming back to, I see it as coming back to God, to what it, whatever it is, that force in the universe that from which I was, we were all born and come into this physical form and then go back, ultimately back to when this short life is over. I see that this everything is God and nothing but God. That theology really does permeate my practice, my life. And I have seen the fruit of that being in my consciousness, in my awareness. And when I am aware in that way, what I notice is that I am kinder. I am more awake. And so the practices that I do are for that end. It's to that end. I want to wake up more. I want to be kinder. I want to get closer to that spark. And so we're practicing in our own homes right now, or in homes, maybe they're not ours. We're, even if they are ours, we're only tenants there, for a bit. We're not going to be here forever. And the physical, I even saw a tent. Somebody's in a tent. The tailors, I think, are in a tent, which is nice too, because I think that's actually a more apropos description of what it, the places that we're living in, because they really are kind of more temporary than we like to think of them as. And in some ways, it's really nice to be able to practice at home. I have my own bed, I have my own bathroom, my own routine. But I also want to talk about the other house that I kind of talked about before, but we're practicing in our bodies, right? And that's the key to this practice, I think, for my own practice. Because if you think, look, the only place that you can practice is in your body. That's where you live, right? That more than any place you ever lived, more than your house, more than the space you're in, more than whatever geographic location you're in, your body is it. It's all, that's it. That's all you get. It's what you get, right? What you got is, that's what it is. It's the only way that we can really experience this life. But I know that for myself, and this is something that I've heard from other people too, that I've who have worked with, it's that many times we get frustrated with our body. We get contentious with it, or disdainful of it, or maybe even feel alienated by it. It's like, dang body, why won't you just do what I want you to do, right? Like, why can't you just, I want to get up early. Why can't you get up early when I want to get up early, right? Why can't you be tired when I told you you should be tired? And you know, why can't you stop craving the thing that I know is not good for me? Or why can't you look more like whatever the media wants me to look like? Or what, you know, why can't I, whatever, right? There's so many ways in which the relationship with my body is not always on peaceful ground. But, you know, to circle back just to the title of the talk, if you didn't know me before, you wouldn't know that as you see me now, you're seeing, you know, Ariel 10% lighter. You're seeing the product of, and it wasn't a purposeful process. It wasn't a diet or a program there was no component of purposefully seeking to lose weight in any way. It's just what I realized when I realized that this body is the only place that I inhabit. And I realized that this is where I live. This is my home. While I'm here on this planet, this is it. This is all I get. Right? So it's like to alienate myself, to talk to myself in a way that is unkind is almost, it just doesn't make sense at a certain point, because this body is my best friend in some way. It's the only thing I can really count on being here for me. So the ways that I would harm my body just didn't make sense. It's like, it's just, once I saw that, I mean, once I could see that and feel that and know that, it just shifted my relationship in a major way. So I'll talk more about that, but I want to also kind of go into the next piece of this, which is the freedom through valence, practicing for freedom. So a few years, I don't remember when it was actually, but I called Sylvia Borstein probably a year ago. Some of you know her or have heard of her. Sylvia is Jeff's first teacher, and I consider her to be our first teacher of meditation. Zalman preceded her in Jeff's lineage, but I consider her my spiritual bubby. She's my teacher, my teacher's teacher, and I also have a relationship with her. I'm lucky enough for that, to build a relationship with her over these past few years. And I remember asking her, you know, what do you think is most, if I'm going to only teach people in short segments of time, if I'm going to do a half day or a day or whatever, you know, not full retreats, what's the most important practice to teach? And she said, the most important practice for you to teach people is to recognize the valence, to recognize the feeling tone, whether you like it, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And that is the if she had to say one practice, it's like asking, you know, the Hillel Shammai question of what's Judaism all about, right? And they say, it's like you can't say it in one sentence what it's all about. But if you had to say it in one sentence what it's all about, she said, this is what it's all about, right? It's just, you have to start to learn. If you want to be free, first you have to know what you're feeling and how you are feeling about it. Like, do you like it or do you don't like it, or do you have no feeling about it at all? Because without knowing that, we're unconscious. We are asleep. We are automatic. We are habituated. We're going through life being pushed and pulled around by what we like and what we don't like, and trying to get on, you know, Ruth talked about it. She said, it's what's bubbling underneath and driving our movement to something we like, away from something we don't like. You know, it says, I love cookies and chocolate. I want more and more cookies and chocolate, right? That's like a good food example. But it's the same when last night I was walking the dog, and it was a very hot day here in Houston. It was 100, feels like 111, which I don't even know. It's when you start to get into the triple digits and it's 111, it's like, whoa. I don't even know what that means. And then, so I'm outside, and it was all of a sudden a breeze came, and it was, I don't know if it was actually cool, but relatively it was cool. And it felt so good, to the point where I actually said a blessing. I said one of the traditional blessings, shekacha lo be'olamo, that this is how it is in the wherever the divine is. This is what it's like, right? And I could feel in that moment that there was almost an automatic, I like this, and I want more, right? Can I live here forever, right? Can I just be here and it always feel like this kind of breeze, exactly like this, right? And even though I know that I can't live there, and there is no such thing as pleasant all the time, and I know from my economics and business background that there's the law of diminishing return, right? That like the first cookie is very good, but the 10th cookie does not feel as good, right? And the 20th cookie feels terrible, right? And the 30th cookie, it just like now you're freely forcing it, right? It's the law of diminishing return, but it's the same in economic terms, but it's the same in our practice. It's like we want something pleasant, and then we want more of the thing that's pleasant until it's no longer pleasant. And now it's like, and then it can go from no longer pleasant to unpleasant. And we know that, but it's hard to unhook from that sometimes. Let's say a less charged version of that is to say, like, you know, we're sitting in our spaces and it may feel from time to time like it's too warm, right? So what do you do, right? If you're like me, you're instantly thinking about how do I change the thermostat, right? Or how do I peel off a layer of clothes so that I'm more comfortable? Or if you're too hot or too cold, whatever, right? We just instantly, and Ruth has talked about it too, in terms of a small discomfort. Like even now, I've just noticed, I'm sitting here, my ankle became just like literally just this moment, my ankle became a little bit tingly, a little bit of a throb in it. And so what did I do? Like before I could even think of it, I stopped sitting on it, right? I released it from underneath me. And how much of our lives are spent that way? In this automatic response to pleasant and unpleasant. And it's not that it's a good or bad thing. It's just to start to notice the ways that we are run by those things. Just checking in. Jeff, are you getting closer because it's hard to hear me? Oh, okay. Okay. It's not always linear either. This work is not always linear. It's not that I can always see how it's happening as it's happening. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion. But once you start to know the methods of the technology, of how the mind works, of how are your own, and it's not just, we can teach you the general principles here, but you ultimately have to apply them and run them on your own system and start to see how you particularly, based on the way that you grew up and the way that you've made sense of your life, the way that you've been raised, the way that you think about how you were raised, right? All of those things add up to who you are now, And that's unique in its own way. So there are some really interesting principles, and I hope that you can take from my story the principles, but understand that you have your own journey that you have to unpack in your own way. Right? I started my 10% lighter journey by noticing how much I focus on food. So much so that the beginning of my spiritual journey, in what was really just a blessing and luck in some huge way, is I began by noticing how much I focus on food and how central it is to me, and wanting to have a spiritual connection in that, that could be pervasive in my life. And I began by making blessings over foods. When I was 19 years old, something like that, 18, 19 years old, I started blessing the food that I put into my body as a way of connecting with the divine, with something bigger than me, with a sense of wonder and gratitude every time I ate. And I knew that that would be a good way in for me, because I knew that it was so top of mind. Like, for example, Jeff talked about how when he's eating, sometimes he's already thinking about going to get the next serving while he's still, like, there's still food on his plate and he's thinking about the next serving. Mine is like that, except it's like I'm eating breakfast and I'm thinking about to myself, what am I going to have for lunch? Like, I'm not even done with breakfast. You know what I mean? The fork is still in my hand. I'm chewing and I'm not even satiated yet. And I'm thinking about the next meal. So it's so central in my own psyche. Food is so central in my own psyche that I tried to leverage that, the centrality of it for me in a spiritual way, because I understood how important and how much of my attention goes there. And so I started doing that many years ago. And so I knew that there was something there in terms of how connected and to the food that I am. But I didn't also realize some other pieces of that had to unfold over time. And so one of the things I also have noticed is that how uncomfortable I am or used to be after I ate. Like, I would just feel terrible after eating. And in the past few years, I've been doing jiu-jitsu. So I'm a jiu-jitsu blue belt, takes about 2 years to earn a blue belt. And 2 years of very hard training, of 5 days a week, of an hour a day training, and grappling, fighting for real. And what I noticed through my food is, like, I would notice how what I ate and when I ate it and how much of it I was eating was impacting my training. Like, I would notice my endurance, my energy, my ability to focus, all revolving around how much or how little or what, when I ate my food, how much sleep I'm getting. And I had to start to pay attention, because I really wanted to get better at jiu-jitsu. I had to start really paying attention to the way that my body is more like a machine. It's a machine that I have to take care of so that I can do jiu-jitsu better, right? But that's one small microcosm of the bigger thing, which is that I started to realize over the past while that some of my childhood wounds, and I sort of talked about this a little bit in the beginning when we just started the retreat, which is that some of the ways that I encoded what reality is and what's true about reality, the story I tell myself about what's true about the world, came from my childhood. And, like, I'll say this without, it's not from a place of, like, bitterness or anger or anything like that. I love my mom, really. I appreciate her. I honor her. I respect her. I still speak to her regularly. I seek counsel from her. And I was a tough kid. Like, I was really hard to deal with. I know that. I'm not trying to absolve myself of that. And sometimes her way of dealing with me being difficult was not to deal with me at all. That is to say, to the point of neglect, she would not talk to me for sometimes weeks on end. And that hurt me. And that left an impact on how I walk through the world. In terms of my feeling, like when people get quiet and around me, I interpret that as a punishment, that there's something wrong. But tied together with that was that I never went hungry. Like, she always fed me, always. Right, there was always good food on the table, and as much of it as I could eat, as much of it as I'd like. And so I remember I was sitting on retreat, on a 3-week retreat with some of you. Actually, some of you were on that retreat or popped in and out of that retreat. Jeff for sure was there, and I remember feeling a different, not in the food context, but I remember feeling about halfway through the retreat how much longing I felt, the desire for touch. I really, like, I'm a very affectionate person. I like touch. Touch is one of the ways that I receive love and give love. And I remember after, you know, on retreats, I mean, you know this now because we're all in our own respective spaces, but on retreat, when we're together, we don't touch each other. We don't even look at each other, you know. After a week or so, I just started to feel this really great desire for, longing for touch, to be touched. And I could feel that, I could feel where it was inside of my body. I could notice where I felt that. It's like right in the pit of my stomach, this desire to feel loved. Because touch for me is love. It's not just I don't want to just be touched. I want to feel loved, right? And I could feel that right in the pit of my stomach. And instead of pushing it away or trying to move, like, I don't know, do something with it or I notice that it's uncomfortable, right? I notice where it is. I can feel it even now. I can feel it just talking about it. And I would just be with it, right? Just like we're talking about, the instructions for today are to notice what's going on in your body and to be with it in the best way that you know how. And so I was doing that. I was doing the instructions, and it came to mealtime. And all of a sudden, I noticed that I was sitting at the table, and I was getting my food on my plate, and I started to feel that feeling again. It was like, and it was a moment of insight, and I could feel that I was desiring to use the food to fill that pit, that whatever that feeling of desire for love, I was trying to use food, and I had been trying to use food to fill that for so long without even knowing it. So, like, I didn't understand why mealtimes were so important to me, why food was so top of mind, but once I could feel that feeling, that longing, in that context. It was like I had to feel it outside of that context, know what it feels like, be okay with it coming up, and then notice it again in the context of this, of my relationship with food. And then also knowing my past and how I interpreted the neglect and how food was never lacking and how food, maybe even my wires might've got crossed a little bit in terms of, you know, attributing food to love, at least I can get love that way, right? If I can't get it from having interaction or physical touch or anything like that. And all of a sudden it was very clear. It was like, oh my God, I'm trying to fill the love, the bucket with a hole in it, this love bucket. I'm trying to fill the love bucket with food. And it was like, that's not going to work, man. Like, it was just a moment of, it was even funny at that moment. It was like, it was profound, but it was also laughable. It was like, oh my God. Like, I was so grateful for the ability to see it, as painful as it was in that moment, to realize that I had really like seeded that connection at such a young age when I really didn't know any better, and then carried that with me for so many years. Just like, there's no amount of food that's going to fill that. There's no amount of food. The best thing that I could hope for is to supplant that feeling with a feeling that is terrible enough that I have to focus on that instead of feeling that lack of love feeling. And that's what I was doing. I was doing this harm to my body, overeating to the point of bursting, so that I would no longer have to feel that empty, not loved enough feeling. But there's this inner child thing that's going, please just give me another serving. I want another cookie, right? Like, it's just like, it's almost existential. It's like, if I don't have enough love, maybe I'll die of not enough love, right? And I think that is what it felt like when I was younger. And one of the things they taught us in rabbinic school when we got closer to ordination is like child psychology. And so just so that we could understand the difference in how kids' minds work at different ages. And I remember the connection, one of the phases of childhood, when a kid asks questions when they're younger, when they ask like, but who, you know, they're asking like, who's going to take me to school? You know, because like maybe grandma lives with you and grandma's going on vacation, but who's going to take me to school? And the real question that they're asking is like, am I going to be okay? That the real question is that they're asking is not about who's going to take me to school at that age, right? The age when I formed this belief about how the world works, and especially through food, it was like, if my mom is mad and she's being quiet, am I going to die because I'm not going to be cared for? Am I not going to be loved? Right. Because as a really young kid, that's the only way that I could understand is like, it's existential at that point. And so I wired it deep, right? I wired that feeling, the feeling of like, of fear, of desire for love, and with this, is my mom going to take care of me now or not, because she's mad and I know I've done something wrong, but maybe not this wrong, but I don't know that because I'm too young to know that, right? And now at least I'm getting food, and that's a constant in my life, and I can count on that, and I can fill myself up beyond fullness, beyond really my satiated level. And I only realized through the practice that that feeling is not a new feeling. That is an old, old feeling that I implanted many, many years ago. And I've been trying to outrun for all these years subtly by going away, by trying to move away from the discomfort. Jeff told a story like this also similarly, like he didn't realize, I hope it's okay that I share this, but you've told this story so many times, I feel like everybody here might have already heard it. It's like when he didn't realize when he was younger how he connected to in his adult life, he didn't realize what it was about sweets and cookies and things like that that got him so that like sort of hooked him in times of distress. And one day when his kids were young, he saw his mom, like one of the kids fell, scraped a knee, and all of a sudden his mom was like at the rescue, here, take a cookie, right? And it was like, and you could see, and it was only in that moment that he could start to see what had, like the way that he'd been conditioned, that when you scrape a knee, you give the kid a cookie, right? And so it's the same thing in our lives. It's like the ways that we were connected with food in a very young age, they wire us together in terms of neurologically, we were wired in that way. It's like, oh, something hurts, let me go get a chocolate, right? Oh, something hurts, let me go get the cookie, right? That's what happens in so many ways in our life. It's like in my own life, this particular lesson of pleasant and unpleasant really has been the key to my freedom in such a huge way. And this is just one part of it, right? Like I notice when I'm anxious, when I'm feeling stressed, all of a sudden I'm in the pantry more often, right? I'm checking the fridge. I'm opening the fridge. I'm standing there. I'm looking at what's happening in there. What do I got? You know, I start to feel cravings for foods that I don't normally crave. If I shut that down, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow in terms of some of the hindrances. But if I shut that down, the craving piece, then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, why don't I have a fight with my wife? That'll definitely make this feeling go away. A fight with my wife would definitely solve my craving for love and my anxiety, because, you know, nothing better to distract me like a good fight. And when I can start to see the pattern, right, I can start to recognize the feeling of where that comes from, of like actually feeling, oh, it's right here. It's right in my chest. It's right there. Right. So it's not that it's like all of a sudden magically I don't have that pattern anymore. I still have the pattern, but now I can notice, oh, that's the feeling of discomfort when I feel like I need more love, when I feel like I'm stressed, when I feel like whatever's going on. And sometimes that leads me to the pantry. Sometimes that leads me to another scoop that I didn't really need of ice cream. And sometimes that leads me to fight my wife. You know, to start a fight for the sake of, for no reason, really, just looking for one. So now let's shift into Bubby consciousness and the inner infant. Cause I feel like we sometimes give a new tool, but we don't, because you need to sort of use the tool a little bit and just get comfortable with it. We don't give you all of the pieces of the tool all at once, but I feel like this is the other part of the tool that we didn't give you earlier today, but that will be very helpful. It has been very helpful for me, and maybe will be helpful for you in your own practice, which is we have a responsibility in our tradition, ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha. That's the essence of all of practice. When Hillel, the famous Hillel and Shammai story in the Talmud, they're asked, what's the essence of Judaism? One of them says, get away from me, right? And the other one says, no, the essence is ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha. You should love your fellow as you love yourself. And I think people get that phrase backwards. what they think is that it means, and this is, it's okay that they get it backwards, because ultimately it's like not the worst thing, but it really does, it's missing the point. What they think it's talking about is being kind to other people. You shall love your neighbor, right? They think that what you're talking about is being good to other people. It's true that it is, but it's in the backwards order, because in the grammar, in the Hebrew grammar, "Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha" actually places primary the self part. You shall love your neighbor as yourself, but in the, it's like the translation is off. It's basically you have to love yourself in order to love other people. First, you need to work on loving yourself, and then you will know how to love other people, right? It's like, I have to love myself first. I have to start at home, and this body that I have, that's all I have, right? It's about honoring my body's limits. And many times only in retrospect, like, I trained too hard, I ate too much, I didn't sleep enough, I had a conversation too late at night that got me too riled up, and then I couldn't fall asleep, or I kept my phone in my bed and now all of a sudden that's very hard for me to sleep, or, right, there's so many ways that we go down those roads. And for me, many times it was eating myself to the point where I was like ready to pop and doing harm to myself in that way. And sometimes we do it after having done it for many, many, many times. Most of the time, actually, I would say that the practice begins only after we've done it 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 times in a way that actually hurts us, is not the most wholesome way. Only after. But through the practice and through the recognition of doing the work of noticing the pattern of the my thought process, going back to my body, how I'm actually feeling, right? Strip away the, like, if we think of our mind, of our thoughts as a sense instead of believing it, the story that we're telling, then many times the mind as a thought process can actually help me remember to go back to what I'm feeling on my physical level, to notice, is this feeling pleasant or unpleasant? Do I like this thought or do I not like this? And where do I feel it in my body, right? And then starting to really get familiar with what's happening on the physical level. And once I can get familiar with and feel comfortable there and know that this is actually not an unsafe feeling to be with, right? And everybody's at a different point in this, right? Ruth very skillfully described the titrating and not doing, and some part of this is also knowing not to do harm to yourself and say like, oh, this is an important feeling for me to feel. It's overwhelming me and all of my alarm bells are going off inside when I'm trying to work with this, but I'm going to try to do it anyway. Like, no, that is harm to yourself. There's no, you don't get extra points for beating yourself up, right? You do not get extra points. So we let it be a little bit like less. Okay, so I look a little bit from the side of my eye instead of directly at it, right? I take a little bit of it as much as I can. I notice it as much as I can, and I leave it be for a little while, and I come back to it a little bit later, right? There's a skill in that. If you can be with it, to be with it, right? As you get comfortable being with that discomfort, that uncomfortable feeling, be with it. And when you can be with it even more, right, then all of a sudden it loses its power over you. It's like, oh, you know what? I don't need to go down that pattern of feeling like I'm not loved enough around food, because I can actually feel directly the desire for love. And I can notice how uncomfortable that is, and I can give it what I want to offer you as a skill, as a tool. I can offer it Bubby consciousness or Grandma consciousness or Safta consciousness, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's interesting. I use the feminine, but for me, the consciousness is actually Saba consciousness. It's my grandfather who was the one who gave me that kind of love. And it's like to be your own inner grandma Bubby, Grandpa, your own inner voice to respond to the child inside you that's saying, but I want to watch all of the news, but I want to finish all of this whole Netflix series right now, even though it's 2 in the morning, but I want another cookie, but I want to push my body harder. That'll satisfy my ego. And I want to stay up late and I want to do all these things, right? But what we know is that doing harm to our body in that way, it's like if you had a two, it's like if my son is 1 year old, you know, and he wants what he wants. And he doesn't want what he doesn't want. And he doesn't have words around it. He just cries and thrashes around and throws a tantrum and yells, right? Like, and there's a part of us inside that's doing the same exact thing. It's exactly the same thing. It's just saying like, but I don't like that. But I want more of that. Give me more of that. And it's our job as people who are paying attention to say, I know you want that. I know you want to feel love, right? To start to pay attention. I know you want to feel that love, Ariel, but feeding yourself to the point of feeling like you're going to pop is not going to satisfy that. And to the contrary, it's going to do harm to this home that you live in, right? It's going to do harm to this. The only friend you have for your whole life is this body. I'm going to have to live here in 2 hours also, right? I'm going to have to live here in half an hour from now after that last bite, right? I reside here and I'm going to have to be with myself tomorrow and the day after that and until my dying day. So it's part of it is like to know inside, say to, from a place of wisdom, from a place of knowing to say like, I know you want that. I know that's how you feel. But that's not going to be it right now, Ariel. No. No, Ariel, not like that. I'm going to give you love. I'm going to give you love in a different way. Right? To notice the discomfort that comes up in my body and to be able to turn to it and say, come here, Bubby. Come here, lovely. Ariel, you're such a cutie. I know you want that, right? I know you want that. I know this is hard for you right now. I know this one is a tough one. I know, but that road, you know, getting into a fight, that's not going to solve this, right? No, it's not going to solve that, right? So like, let me bring that kindness, that compassion to myself. And then we're starting to heal from the inside out. We can learn to do that by noticing the pleasant, the unpleasant. Because ultimately for me, it's like, this is my God Sparks house. Right? This is where the part of me that connects with all things lives. And it may not be how I wish it was, but it's all I've got. And I want to love it, right? I want to treat it the best way possible so that I can stay lit up, so that my God spark can shine through and that I can be kind to myself and to the people in my environment that need more love, like my son and my wife and all of the people I love in my life. And it starts at home. It starts with the body. Our bodies really are our friends in this. They can be our friends in this process. And when we first we have to be willing to hear what they've got to teach us, right? And to know that they're on our side, right? They may not know how to go about it. They may have encoded really unwise ways of doing it from when we were really young because we didn't know any better. We just didn't. We did our best, right? We thought it was existential at that time. And so we did whatever we needed to do to make it through. And now we can wake up to it. Now we can wake up to how those things were encoded and choose a different way with freedom. With freedom. That's why it's so important to keep doing this practice on the body level, to notice the pleasant, the unpleasant. Right? And grandparent yourself. When you notice that something is uncomfortable, you can speak to yourself. you can give yourself the love that your grandparents, that a good grandparent would have given, that a good grandparent would have given you. Maybe not your own, but your own inner version of that, the one that just loves you and just holds you and just kisses you. And you can do that for the part of you that's having difficulty. And this is the promise of the practice, is that kind of freedom.